I don't think there's anything else to be done, the doctor calling me said down the phone. But he would like you to look at his scans. He has great faith in you. I've already shown them to one of the neurosurgeons here, and he wasn't keen. I'm leaving the country tomorrow morning for a few days, I said. Send the scans to me electronically, and I'll have a look at them next week. Of course, she replied. I'll do that. Thanks. Snow was now falling. As I pulled back onto the motorway and continued on my way, I found myself engaged in a painful internal dialogue. By chance, I was only a short distance away from the hospital to which David had been admitted, and it would be a minor detour to go and see him in person. I really don't want to go and tell him he is going to die, I said to myself. I don't want to spoil a nice weekend away with my wife, but I felt a sort of dragging sensation deep inside myself. Ultimately, if I was dying, I heard myself saying, wouldn't I appreciate a visit from the surgeon in whom I have put my hope for so many years? But I really don't want to tell him it is time to die. Angrily, reluctantly, I took the next turning off the motorway and drove to the hospital. It rose like a monolith out of a huge surrounding car park. I walked unhappily along the endless long central corridor inside. It seemed to go on for miles and miles, but perhaps this was the effect of my dread at going to talk to my dying patient. I experienced once again my visceral hatred of hospitals and their dull, indifferent architecture within the walls of which so much human suffering must be acted out. At least the lifts, as I ascended to the fifth floor, didn't tell me to wash my hands as they do in my own hospital. But the voice telling me when the doors were opening and closing sounded even more irritating than usual. I finally walked onto the ward. I found David standing by the nurse's station, in pyjamas, towering above a little group of nurses who were propping him upright. He was leaning a little to one side because of his left-sided weakness. The doctor who had phoned me was standing next to him and came towards me. "They all think I'm a magician. I ring you up, and within 15 minutes you appear." I walked up to David, who laughed with amazement at my sudden arrival. "You again?" he said. "Yes," I said. "I'll go and look at the scans." I was taken to a nearby computer. I had not met the doctor caring for him before, although we had exchanged letters about David. It was immediately obvious that she was deeply sympathetic. "I look after all the patients with the low-grade gliomas," she said with a slight grimace. "Motor neurone disease and MS are easy by comparison. The patients with low-grade gliomas are all young, with young children, and all I can say is go away and die. My children are the same age as David's, go to the same school. It's difficult not to get involved, not to get emotional." I looked at the scan on the computer. It showed that the tumour, which was now cancerous, was burrowing deep into his brain. The fact that the tumour was on the right side of his brain meant, as had been the case with Helen, that his intellect and understanding were still largely intact. "Well, I could operate," I said, "but it probably would not buy him much more time. A few months at best. It would be prolonging dying, not living. It would waste what little time he has left with false hope, and would not be without risk. He's always made it clear to me that he wanted to know the truth." I thought of the other patients I had reoperated on in the past in similar circumstances, such as Helen, who could not bear to face the truth, and how I had usually regretted it. "But it is so very difficult to tell your patient that there is nothing more that can be done, that there is no hope left, that it is time to die. And then there is always the fear that you might be wrong, that maybe the patient is right to hope against hope, to hope for a miracle, and maybe you should operate just one more time. It can become a sort of folie à deux, where both doctor and patient cannot bear reality." While I was looking at the scans, David had been guided back to the single room to which he had been admitted the previous day, unconscious and half-paralysed, before the high-dose steroid drugs temporarily brought him back to life. I walked into the room where his wife and two nurses were standing at the end of the bed. The afternoon light was fading, and the room was dark as the electric lights had not yet been switched on. Through the window, I could see the sombre day outside, and the hospital car park a few stories below us, and beyond that a line of trees and houses, with snow falling but not settling on the ground. David was lying on his back, and turned with an effort towards me as I came in. I stood a little nervously above him. "I've been looking at the scans." I paused. "I always told you I'd tell you the truth." I noticed that he was not looking at me as I spoke, and I realized that I was on his left hemianopic side. He probably could not see me as the right side of his brain was no longer working, so I walked round the bed and, with my knees cracking, knelt down beside him. To stand over your dying patient would be as inhuman as the long hospital corridors. We looked into each other's eyes for a moment. "I could operate again," I said slowly, having to force the words out, "but it would only get you an extra month or two at best. I have sometimes operated on people in your situation. I usually regretted it." David started to reply, talking equally slowly. I realized things did not look good. There were various things I needed to organize, but I've done that all now. I've learned over the years that when breaking bad news, as it is called, it is probably best to speak as little as possible. These conversations, by their very nature, are slow and painful, and I must overcome my urge to talk and talk to fill the sad silence. I hope I do these things better than I did in the past, but I struggled as David looked at me, and I found it difficult not to talk too much. I said that if he was a member of my own family, I would not want him to have any more treatment. "Well," I said, eventually getting control of myself, "I suppose I've kept you going for a good few years." In the past, he'd been a competitive cyclist and runner, and he had large, muscular arms. I felt awkward as I shyly reached out to hold his big, masculine hand. "It's been an honour to look after you," I said, and stood up to leave. "It's a bit inappropriate, but all I can say is good luck," I added, unable to say goodbye, since we both knew it would be for the last time. I stood up. His wife came towards me, her eyes full of tears. I buried my face in her shoulder, holding her fiercely for a few seconds, and then left the room. His doctor followed me. "Thank you so much for coming. It'll make everything much easier. We'll get him home and organize palliative care," she said. I waved my hands despairingly in the air and walked away, imitating the staggering walk of a drunk on too much emotion. "I'm happy," I called back to her as I walked down the corridor. "It was good, so to speak, to have that conversation. Will I be so brave and dignified when my time comes?" I asked myself as I walked out into the grim black asphalt car park. The snow was still falling, and I thought yet again of how I hate hospitals. I drove away in a turmoil of confused emotions. I quickly became stuck in the rush-hour traffic and furiously cursed the cars and their drivers, as though it was their fault that this good and noble man should die and leave his wife a widow and his young children fatherless. I shouted and cried and stupidly hit the steering wheel with my fists, and I felt shame, not at my failure to save his life. His treatment had been as good as it could be, but at my loss of professional detachment and what felt like the vulgarity of my distress compared to his composure and his family's suffering, to which I could only bear impotent witness.